Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Carly. My name is Ajam DK. I'm the Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and I want to thank everyone for joining us this afternoon on this very important and timely topic. We're delighted to have an esteemed, diverse, and experienced group of speakers this afternoon. And I'm looking forward to an engaging conversation. We'll start off with the speakers, and then there'll be ample time for the callers to participate in the discussion. So, again, thank you for joining us. I will hand over briefly to our membership coordinator, Sakajiwa Hall, who's going to make a brief announcement, and then we will turn over to Tanya, who has kindly, Tanya Williams has kindly agreed to moderate this conversation today.
This is Saki. I'm the membership coordinator, and I want to, again, welcome everyone on the call. I'm going to make an announcement again at the end, but we just wanted to extend membership to everyone who's on the call. We'd really love for you to join if you aren't a member already, and you can do that on our homepage at the Join Us tab.
Thanks. And so with that, we'll hand over to Tanya.
Thank you, Ajam. Once again, my name is Tanya Williams, and I'm an assistant professor of political science at Johnson C. Smith University, but I'm also a board member at Spark Reproductive Justice Now. Once again, we want to thank everyone for participating in today's discussion concerning the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act and the broader human right to healthcare movement in the United States. The healthcare reform debate and the passage of the Affordable Care Act have become one of the most politically contentious issues in American politics in recent memory. To be sure, the Affordable Care Act, irrespective of the Supreme Court ruling, lacked many of the principles and standards that are reflected in the human rights obligations contained in several treaties, and consequently did not achieve universal access to healthcare based on need. However, the health care insurance reform did include new substantive protections and modifications that could and should have positive implications for communities least likely to have access to quality, affordable, equitable health care. Our diverse group of presenters this afternoon will offer a broad range of experiences, perspectives, and prescriptions for realizing health care as a human right in general and the implications of the Supreme Court ruling on the Affordable Care Act. While the reform has become the hallmark legislation of the Obama presidency and the call to arms and rallying cry for the right, the national conversation about health care as a public good, as a basic human right, has been neglected. Ultimately, our hope is that this call will be the beginning, not the end, of the conversation and retrenchment of the grassroots mobilization efforts that many of us have been engaged in over the years for universal health care that meets the needs of everyone. In addition, we hope this discussion will not solely facilitate a better understanding of the reform and the Supreme Court decision, but will foster greater coordination between groups at all levels and across states and movements to ensure implementation of the reforms meets the needs of our communities and continue in our collective effort to build a human rights culture in the United States. While we have identified a diverse group of speakers, we know that many of you on the call have also been engaged in this work and encourage you to offer a brief statement when time permits on issues that may not have been raised by our presenters. To that end, let me briefly introduce the format of today's discussion. We will have six presenters that will speak for approximately 4 to 6 minutes, and then we will open the floor for discussion. Kali has already provided the information about how to get in the queue for questions in the question and answer period. And we want to encourage everyone to stay on the call and participate in that session, that part of the session. The first speaker will be Aaron Chavez, the Policy Counsel for Foreign Policy and Human Rights at the Center for Reproductive Rights. Next, Anya Ruttinger, Director, Human Rights to Health Program Director at the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. Next, Kimberly Inez McGuire, National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Keely Monroe, Law Students for Reproductive Justice Fellow, Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need. Next, we'll have Heidi Williamson, board member, Spark Reproductive Justice Now, and legislative and advocacy consultant. And finally, Mary Goresh, policy committee chair, coordinating committee, Vermont Worker Center. And then, of course, as I mentioned at the very end, we would encourage all of you to offer questions and statements concerning the Supreme Court ruling, but also the broader healthcare as a human rights movement. With that said, Aaron, you're up.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Tanya, for the introduction. And just FYI, my name is Itz Aram with an M. And as she mentioned, I'm policy counsel at the Center for Reproductive Rights. And I'll just speak briefly about the decision itself, what it did, what it didn't do, what's good about the decision, what's not good about the decision, and sort of where we go from here. And obviously, I'll be on the call. I can stay until 4:30 and would be happy to answer questions that people have. So as everyone on the call knows, last week the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. The full decision of the court, including the primary decision and the dissents and concurrences, are about 200 pages long. It dealt with challenges from about 26 states as well as private actors. So there were several surprises in the ACA decision. First, the outcome, the fact that the law itself was actually upheld. It seemed like most people thought that that was not what was going to happen. Second, the grounds upon which the decision was made. It was held that the individual mandate was permissible under Congress's tax authority and not under its power to regulate commerce. And third surprise was the constitution of the majority. Everyone expected the liberals and the conservatives to split, and people thought if there was going to be a swing vote, it would be Justice Anthony Kennedy. Instead, of course, the swing vote was Justice John Roberts, the Chief Justice, who voted with the liberals. And in fact, some of the articles that have come out since have indicated that Justice Kennedy, far from being a swing vote, actually was really arguing and urging Roberts to join the conservative side. So that's sort of an interesting development. So briefly, what did the court do? The 5-justice majority, meaning the 4 liberal justices, Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, plus Roberts, upheld the court's power, the Supreme Court's power, to review the Affordable Care Act, saying that it was not a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act. That's a law that Congress has passed that basically says that you can't challenge a tax until it's come into effect. So for purposes of that law and the court's ability to review it, it was considered not to be a tax. The 5-justice majority also upheld the individual mandate, which requires individuals to carry health insurance and to purchase it if they don't have it, as an exercise of its tax authority under Article Section 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which says that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. This is an interesting development because President Obama and many of the ACA supporters have repeatedly stated that the ACA and its penalty under the individual mandate was not a tax, and that was obviously for political reasons. They didn't want to be seen as something that was raising taxes. The government did make that argument during oral arguments that it was a tax, but that was really their ancillary argument. That was sort of their third-in-line argument, and it wasn't one that they paid a whole lot of attention to. So what did the court not do in the decision? The court did not accept the government's main argument that this was an exercise, that the ACA and the individual mandate were an exercise under the Commerce Clause. That's the section of the Constitution that says that Congress may, quote, regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, there's no official binding opinion that rejects it, but 5 justices all voted against it. The fact is that 4 of them voted together as a dissent, Kennedy, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas, and then Roberts made the similar argument separately. So there was no 5-judge decision that rejected the Commerce Clause clearly, but there are 5 justices altogether who did. And these 5 justices, these 5 conservative justices, basically bought lock, stock, and barrel the novel argument that was advanced by Professor Randy Barnett at Georgetown and embraced by other conservatives of this distinction between action and inaction. And the idea that Congress, while it can regulate existing commerce, it can't, quote unquote, create commerce by forcing people to buy things. That's the famous, you know, can the government force people to buy broccoli because it's healthy argument. And basically the Supreme Court bought the broccoli. In addition, the Supreme Court also rejected an argument justifying the Affordable Care Act under the so-called Necessary and Proper Clause, which is part of sort of the catch-all phrase in the Constitution that says Congress can do anything that's necessary and proper in order to carry out its other enumerated powers. So that's another place where it was not accepted. Separately, the court struck down the Medicaid expansion, which would have expanded Medicaid coverage to 133% of the poverty line, and that was a vote of 7-2. So that 7 out of the 9 justices bought, everyone except Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor. So Kagan and Breyer are the two liberals who actually went with the conservatives on that part. The court held that the federal government can pressure states and can withhold economic benefits to urge them to do something, but not to coerce them to do something. And that, for example, putting at stake some of the highway funding is fair game, but that withdrawing the entire fund is too coercive in violation of the Constitution. In this case, that would have been 10% of the entire state's budget. All right. Briefly, what's good? What's good is that it upheld the ACA. And as Tanya mentioned in her introduction, while the ACA is far, far, far from perfect, it is a huge step forward. I think most of us would agree on that. It also upheld the individual mandate, which was seen as the linchpin of the law, and that was necessary to avoid the so-called insurance death spiral. So that's good. It also increased Congress's authority under the tax power, something that the Wall Street Journal actually points out today, and that it gives Congress a way to justify legislation, that social welfare legislation, if they can frame it as a tax. What's not good is that 5 justices rejected the argument under the Commerce Clause, and that may seem sort of ancillary for those of you who are not lawyers on the call, but in fact, the Commerce Clause and Congress's ability to regulate interstate commerce is actually the glue that holds together a lot of the civil rights laws in this country. The laws, for example, that prohibit racial discrimination and other forms of discrimination are not based on race, but they're actually in many cases based on Commerce Clause and Congress's ability to regulate commerce. There's a famous case called the Heart of Atlanta Motel that held that in the 1960s. Congress has really been whittling away at this kind of legislation. And Lopez, another case, decided they used the Commerce Clause to strike down a law that would have regulated guns. And in Morrison, another case, it struck down the Violence Against Women Act. Secondly, what's not good about this is that this action-inaction is a distinction without a difference. It's extremely formalistic, and it really means that the court could put in jeopardy a lot of the civil rights legislation that is passed as an overreach of Congress. Now, that is not clear that that will happen, but it certainly could happen, and it's a lot easier to make new laws under a commerce argument than under a tax argument. You think about the politics of saying we're going to increase taxes for social welfare is very different than saying we want to regulate something for social welfare. Another problem with the decision is that the court says buying health insurance is just like any other product, like a car or a flat-screen TV, without any kind of recognition that there's a right to health under international law, or that simply economically speaking, health should be treated differently than any other sorts of consumer goods. And finally, there's the real problem of the Medicaid expansion and the fact that numbers of states may decide to opt out. This means that while the middle class might be reasonably well off under the ACA because they're covered by it, the poor who are covered by Medicaid could be left out in the cold. And in fact, I read in the New York Times, I think, that in Texas, for example, you don't get Medicaid funding unless you make less than $9,000 for a family of four. If you make $9,001 a year for a family of four, you're not covered by Medicaid. That's a huge problem. So you could have a system here where the ACA is upheld and those who are relatively affluent benefit, and those who are extremely poor may be screwed by the court's Medicaid decision. What's happening going forward, of course, folks in the House and others, Eric Cantor, have said that they want to repeal the law. There are existing legal challenges to parts of the law. For example, we've been heavily involved with the access to contraception and the women's preventive services. So that will go on, and we'll see what happens. And obviously, a great deal hinges on both the congressional and presidential election. And as, of course, all of you, I'm sure, are aware, candidate Mitt Romney has pledged to repeal the ACA soon if he were to be elected. Anyway, that's all I have. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Aram. The next speaker will be Anya Runger with NESRI.
you, Tanya. This is Anya here from NESRI, the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. And I want to briefly talk about the human rights implication of the court's decision, of the healthcare reform effort more generally, and then, you know, what we as a human rights movement, what we can do, what are the lessons we can take from that. And so clearly from a human rights perspective, it is really good news that the Supreme Court affirmed the government's authority to ensure health care for all. It would have been pretty sad if it had done anything else. But at the same time, as Aram explained, the court did not refer to any human rights obligations that our government actually has, and that includes the obligation to provide a healthcare system that protects everybody's health in an equitable way. And that is clearly the goal of the human rights movement, one of the many goals of the human rights movement in this country, to seek to make a healthcare system that meets human rights standards a reality. And Aram also explained how detrimental the consequences can be if we don't have a legal system that's based on human rights, then all kinds of other considerations can come into play. And it is really, really difficult to move forward human rights without the Supreme Court or even, you know, Congress or the President to pay any attention to the government's human rights obligations. And so that's why we really need a strong human rights movement in the U.S. to push for those obligations to be recognized. So we never, you know, the courts and Congress and President never examined whether the Affordable Care Act protects the human rights to health care. Now, obviously, the most immediate human rights obligation that the government has is the obligation to save lives, and the Affordable Care Act does that. It helps many people to get coverage and thereby, to some extent, to get health care. So it's good that the Supreme Court decision lets the many beneficial provisions of the Affordable Care Act take effect, and that includes, of course, the increased access to coverage through stricter insurance regulations and through expanding Medicaid. But that's also where we come to the first sort of human rights negative. The court, as Aram said, has allowed states to opt out of the long overdue Medicaid expansion, and it thus opens the door for states to exclude some of the poorest and most disadvantaged people, and many of whom are women and people of color, and to exclude people from access to care, and we'll hear more about this from other panelists in this call. I want to just show that this is really a consequence of our fragmented and tiered healthcare system, which will continue even after the Affordable Care Act fully kicks in 2014. We still have a fragmented system with many different tiers, where access to care depends on a person's income or wealth, and where we have constant threats to public programs through underfunding and through eligibility restrictions, such as the limitation just handed down by the Supreme Court. So this illustrates why, you know, while it may save lives and may help people, as an effort to move us toward a universal health care system, the Affordable Care Act actually does not meet human rights standards. It helps some people, but its structure, that is, the way it is just tweaking our health insurance system, does not provide a step toward a rights-based system of care that we need. And my organization, NESRI, did a detailed human rights assessment 2 years ago when the ACA was passed, and we used the human rights standards of universality, equity, and accountability, and we found that the law was failing on all accounts. So anybody who's interested can look that up on our website. So the main issue is that the Affordable Care Act treats healthcare as a market commodity, not as a human right and a public good, and it actually solidifies the private market-based system in which healthcare is really the domain of a for-profit industry propped up by substantial public subsidies. So what we have on the one hand is entrenching the private industry through forcing everybody to become their customer to buy an insurance product. And then, you know, through subsidizing this purchase, basically funneling public money to private companies, and this system actually leads to severe exclusions and inequities, and that is something that human rights standards do not tolerate. So once you rely on market competition to meet human needs, you end up excluding those people who can't afford to be in the market or who are excluded by the market. So whereas human rights say that everyone must get the health care they need and not just the health care they can pay for. So it's important to note that the Affordable Care Act's constitutionality would not have been questioned if reformers had established a federal tax-funded universal public program modeled after Medicare. So it's actually the treatment of people as consumers of market-based coverage that set the Affordable Care Act off on the wrong path. And so there was already an indication of this during the Supreme Court hearing in March when a number of the justices questioned why the Obama administration hadn't used the correct power and simply raised taxes to establish a national health service or a single-payer system. And it was Justice Roberts then who pointed to the government's role in providing fire, police, and emergency services, and he wondered why health care was treated differently. And the fact is that as a public good, health care should not be treated differently. The goods and services that we need to meet our human needs should be provided as public goods, and human rights require that everyone's needs are met, and the market simply cannot do that. So I think it's really significant that the Supreme Court challenge revealed the central flaw in the Affordable Care Act, and that it actually, on the other hand, confirmed tax-based funding as the correct and the only way towards universal health care. So it allowed the Affordable Care Act to stand, which is good, but it also pointed to the fact that the Affordable Care Act actually just uses taxes to penalize those without coverage. So the tax is imposed if you don't have coverage. The tax is not imposed for actually getting coverage. So that will pitch people against each other. So there'll be those people who pay a tax and still don't have coverage. And then there are people who buy their own coverage, they buy an insurance product, and they still face back barriers to actual care because coverage, as most of you will have experienced, doesn't actually mean you get the care you need. So this may sound somewhat depressing, but it actually is not. As I said, I think it's a good thing that the Supreme Court has pointed toward tax funding as a way to establish a universal health care system, and we don't have to wait for the federal government to get it right. And I believe that the human rights community should not stop at just continue to defend the Affordable Care Act at a time when there is a much better human rights-based model out there that we can support and that other states can implement. So I'm speaking of the model that has been passed last year in the state of Vermont, which many of you might have heard of, and we'll have later on Mary speak about the effort in Vermont. And there we have a people-centered approach to addressing the ongoing healthcare crisis. And this law was actually passed because a grassroots movement for the human right to healthcare pushed the legislature and the governor to do this. And so the law is for a universal publicly financed healthcare system that is financed through tax contribution where nobody is excluded. And this is, you know, this is only possible through human rights movement. So the Vermonters really pulled together a broad-based people's movement to move politicians there, and it will require similar efforts across the country to spread the lessons from Vermont. And there are a number of initiatives, as Mary will tell you later, that are already underway that deserve our support. And I think this is really where we should be looking to. You know, the Supreme Court spotlight on the Affordable Care Act's weaknesses should really motivate all of us to follow Vermont's example and campaign for healthcare as a human right and a public good for all. And that means we should stop treating healthcare as commerce and instead establish a tax-based public funding that can provide healthcare as a public good for all. So that's my my plea to the human rights movement. Thank you.
Thank you, Anya. Our next speaker will be Kimberly Inez McGuire with National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health.
Hello, and thank you so much for pulling together this call. Just to make a quick sort of point of order, National Latino Institute for Reproductive Health, our work around the Affordable Care Act is primarily focused on the impact of the law as it speaks to health, dignity, and justice for Latinas and their families. So just to sort of establish that as the frame that we're examining it, and I will leave the experts on human rights law to have that conversation. So first I want to say, and really echo Aram's comments, that while the ACA is far from perfect, upholding the ACA is absolutely a win for access to health care and therefore a win for the communities that we are most concerned about. And so in particular, I'm going to focus on the impacts on Latinos, immigrants, and LGBTQ community, and of course, happy to answer questions at the end of the call. So to start off, in terms of the expansions in care and the benefits of the ACA, I want to focus on three broad categories. One is that the Affordable Care Act expands access to insurance coverage for people of all incomes and health statuses. Two, that it improves the quality of care, including by providing for culturally and linguistically competent care. And three, that it protects consumers against discrimination. I mean, this is particularly important for LGBTQ folks, but also very important for women and other folks who've experienced discrimination in healthcare. So just a few quick statistics on how the ACA will impact Latinos. First, we know that one in three Latinos is uninsured, and that with the expansions in the Medicaid program, assuming that the states do decide to opt in, and I think we're ready to have that fight in the states, but with the expansion in Medicaid as well as access to private insurance, 6 million Latinos who did not have health insurance before the ACA will have health insurance after. And we think that's going to make a huge impact on access to care and consequently on, start to address some of the health disparities that we know that Latinos experience. The ACA also ends discrimination against folks who have pre-existing conditions. We know that at least one in six Latinos has a pre-existing condition, and so again, that is expanding access to care. And in terms of improving the quality of care, there's a lot in the ACA, both about what that doctor's visit looks like in terms of whether providers are properly trained in language and cultural competence, but it also provides funding for improving workforce diversity, and we know that having workforce diversity is really important and can improve health outcomes. So I'm in transit, so apologies for the that maybe you need to know. It's a bit hard to hear me for about the next 30 seconds or so, but I will keep talking and the moderators let me know if it becomes too disruptive. So moving on to the issue of access to care for immigrants under the ACA, we know that this law is far from perfect, and it's really a mixed outcome. On the one hand, and this is something that we have been critical of from the beginning, undocumented folks and legal permanent residents who've had that status for 5 years or less really don't gain very much from the law, and we always saw this as a major flaw. However, certainly a silver lining in that cloud will be a dramatic expansion of funding for community health centers, which we know are an important lifeline for many underserved communities, including Latino communities and rural communities. But another important sort of sub-bullet under community health centers is that they provide care regardless of status. So while there's no explicit extension of coverage for undocumented folks within the law, we do know that the reality is that many undocumented folks do gain access to health care at community health centers, and they will be expanded under the law. So we're really excited about that, and certainly within the short term as a way to increase access to care for undocumented folks. So looking at a third community that we're really concerned with, we also think that the ACA does expand access to care for LGBTQ folks in several important ways. One, I want to note that, once again, the Medicaid expansion will have a particularly important impact on LGBTQ communities. We know that queer folks are disproportionately poor and face several unique barriers to accessing health insurance. So any expansion in access to insurance availability is going to mean a lot to this community. Some of the barriers that folks currently face are that our health insurance system is largely employment-based. And given the amount of employment discrimination that LGBTQ folks encounter, gaining health insurance through an employer isn't always quite as feasible. We also know that many of our families are not recognized, or relationships are not recognized in ways that allow us to gain coverage from family members. And finally, of particular importance for transgender folks, the prohibition against discrimination against folks who have pre-existing condition is important because in many situations we found that simply being transgender is considered a pre-existing condition and has been used as an excuse to deny care. And that really brings me to, I think, you know, again, one of the important pieces of the ACA for LGBTQ communities, which is that it includes a broad non-discrimination provision, which the administration has specifically said they are interpreting to not only include gender, but also gender identity and sexual orientation. So once again, the notion that an insurance company could discriminate against you for any of those reasons is directly, contravened by the law. So once again, I think with each of these provisions, how it is implemented and how it is enforced will certainly mean a lot, will make a big difference, but we're really excited about the potential. Just a couple other quick aspects of the law that I wanted to focus in on. Another piece of the ACA that will be really exciting for LGBTQ folks is improvements on data collection. We do have some data about health disparities for these populations, but the reality is that we simply don't have the data that we need to develop effective public health interventions. And so within the ACA, there is a plan to expand data collection on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender populations. In particular, it calls for the integration of sexual orientation and gender identity questions into national health data collection surveys. And so we look forward to development of new data resources that will also help facilitate the funding that we need to create and implement relevant public health interventions. So that kind of covers some of the primary aspects and provisions of the law that we think will have a big impact on Latinos, immigrant communities, and LGBTQ folks. And overall, I think not only do we see the ongoing implementation and of this law as a win, but we also see that it lays really important groundwork for future work in reducing health disparities and in improving health equity. Currently we're working on a law with many of, I think, the folks on this call, the Health Equity and Accountability Act, which is a piece of legislation that directly builds on the foundation of the Affordable Care Act to expand health equity beyond the populations that are covered under the ACA and really moving towards even broader access for some of the groups who are currently left out. I think, you know, that kind of forward-looking posture is certainly where the Latin Institute, where we find ourselves, because, you know, we always knew that implementation of this law would be a challenge. We know that with the ruling on Medicaid, that will be an additional challenge. But we're also ready to fight that fight. We're ready to hold policymakers on a state level accountable and ensure that we can really make the most of the law we have and build on it for tomorrow. So with that, again, my apologies for the background noise. I'm on a train, and I'll hand it back to our facilitators.
Thank you very much, Kimberly, for that. The next speaker is going to be Keely Monroe with Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for having me on the call. I'm looking forward to and excited to tell you a little bit about what Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need is doing, both at the national and state level. So Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need is a national initiative that works both at the national level and in 21 states with 23 regional coordinators to ensure that women's voices are heard and concerns are addressed throughout the implementation of the healthcare law. As several speakers have said on this call, this law does not fulfill all of our expectations in healthcare access, but our focus at Raising Women's Voices is to make sure that what the law does offer, women and families know about these benefits and know how to get the services they need in order to stay healthy. So today I'll be speaking about our very exciting and important campaign that we launched in March called Countdown to Coverage, which tells the incredible true story of what the law is doing for women. We know all women of all ages deserve access to quality, affordable care we need to take care of ourselves and our families, yet we haven't historically been systematically denied basic coverage based solely on being a woman and still face serious barriers to access. For example, in a recent three-year period, approximately 7.3 million women, or 38% of those who tried to get health insurance in the individual market, were turned down, charged a higher premium, or had a condition excluded from coverage because it was pre-existing. A pre-existing condition could be something for a woman like being pregnant, having had a prior cesarean section, or having been a victim of intimate partner violence. We're also forced to pay anywhere from 4 to 48% higher premiums than men. And we also know that only 13% of plans sold in the individual market include comprehensive maternity coverage, and that charging high copays for basic preventative care services is a serious barrier to many women. More than half have delayed or avoided preventative care because of its cost. And, of course, if you're a woman of color, the disparities become even greater. Black women are nearly 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than a white woman. Latinas are the group of women most likely to be uninsured, 38% of whom do not have health insurance. Vietnamese women are 5 times more likely to develop cervical cancer. And American Indian, Alaskan Native women have the highest rates of intimate partner violence than any other racial group or ethnic group. So this is a lot of bad news. But a little over 2 years ago, the Affordable Care Act became law and really does try to address some of these long-standing health disparities and discrimination, and does offer something to women, all women, regardless of how rich or poor they may be. It helps women who do have insurance but are paying more than they should because of gender rating. It helps women who have been buried under medical debt because when someone in their family got sick, they found out that their insurance had coverage limits that left them on the hook for devastating medical bills. And it helps women who have been struggling along without insurance, living in fear of any illness because they just can't find a policy that they can afford. Women under 26 now feel security in their coverage because all young adults can now stay on their parents' insurance plans until age 26. And that provision has already started helping millions of young adults. It guarantees maternity coverage and contraceptive coverage with no extra charges. But women have health needs after our reproductive years as well. And the healthcare law does something for women's health across the lifespan. The health law has already given senior women great benefits like mammograms without copays and is continuing to close the donut hole in making prescription drugs more affordable. Right now in our campaign, we're counting down to the new preventative health services that women will be getting starting August 1st. This provision will apply to all new insurance plans and to existing plans when enough changes have been made to qualify them as new. Now, you've probably heard a lot about the contraceptive coverage requirement, and isn't it really great that insured women will now have coverage for birth control and not have to pay out-of-pocket copays and deductibles? And this coverage not only includes birth control pills, but also IUDs and even tubal ligations, which are very expensive. We know that when women can space and plan pregnancies, we have healthier women and healthier babies. And it's also worth remembering that for every dollar spent on contraceptive services, we save 4 on pregnancy care. So this makes a lot of good sense. But what you may not have heard is about all of the other really important preventive services that will also be covered starting August 1st, including an annual well woman care exam, screenings for sexually transmitted diseases, breastfeeding counseling and equipment, screening for gestational diabetes, and screening and counseling for intimate partner violence. So all those preventative services will be included in new private insurance plans without additional cost sharing or copays for women. So what can you do to help? Well, one, you can go to our website, countdowntocoverage.org, to find out more about how you and your family benefit from the law. And then you can tell your story, whether you're a breast cancer survivor who will now finally be able to get health insurance because the health care law ends pre-existing condition denials, or a young adult looking for work or working in an entry-level job with no benefits who can now get insurance by staying on your parents' policy, or a young mother struggling to pay bills and still be able to afford the copays on your contraception. your stories are going to be what moves this law forward and highlights what it offers to women in our families. So that's our Countdown to Coverage campaign that we're launched on the national level. What I just want to also speak briefly about is the work that we do with our 23 regional coordinators. They all work at the state level implementing healthcare reform. And what we do with them is provide support for them, whether it's helping them analyze what the regulations mean, whether it's helping them create state-based activities, supporting them in creating letters to the editor or speeches. So for those in states who are state-based healthcare reform advocates, if you'd like to become involved with that, you can try to contact me at kmonroe@nasinnancywhn.org. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much, Keely, for your presentation. We only have two more presentations until the queue is going to be open for question and answer period, so we should only have about 10 more minutes from our speakers. The next speaker will be Heidi Williamson, who is a board member at Spark Reproductive Justice Now and a legislative and advocacy consultant. Heidi?
Hi. Thank you to the network and Tanya for moderating. I'm thrilled to be a part of this call. I come to you from many movements, the reproductive justice movement, the immigrants rights movement, the LGBT movement. I've worked with a number of organizations in all of these movements. And so when I come to issues like healthcare reform, it is with multiple hats and multiple approaches, but all with the purpose of finding the common strands that these movements share and helping organizations define strategies to work and continue to create policies to move human rights and women's rights forward. So I say that so you can understand a little bit of my approach, and I want people to take away, if you take away nothing else from my little 5 minutes, it is that the Supreme Court upholding ACA is simply one piece of a journey. Now the battles are going to take place in the state, and we need people to be clear that there is a role that you can play at the local level, because it's just one hurdle that we have overcome, and it was a very big hurdle. But there are now battles that have to be fought on the local level, and for whatever success that we think the ACA holds, and I do think that there are a number of things to celebrate about ACA, we have a lot of work to do in the states. And let me just start with giving you a couple of facts. So after the Supreme Court decision came down, I had to remind myself, okay, so where have people been doing what they were supposed to have been doing even when the bill was passed? I mean, some states have been operating like this law is the law of the land. It didn't need a Supreme Court decision, whereas others, as Aram said earlier, were part of the actual litigation and we're waiting for the decision to vindicate them. And the reality is we have about 32 states who've done absolutely nothing by way of planning to implement the exchanges or prepare to receive healthcare dollars or to implement the programming in any way. And we know, I know at least five, by the time I left the office on Friday, at least five states were absolutely certain that they were not going to expand Medicaid, and they didn't want to, and were indicating they didn't want to implement health care reform at all. And of course, we know some of that hinges on what happens in November. And even then, we still may have to see the federal government step in and do a little bit more massaging if we actually want to see it implemented. But for me, when I got the decision, I read it, my primary concern was Medicaid, right? Because the assumption is if we have a Medicaid program that can possibly be expanded, that means more people can be covered, and that's wonderful. But the way that the decision was written that gives the states the option to opt out of Medicaid expansion has huge and broad implications for women of color and poor women. And so we need to be mindful, particularly when we think about two groups, right? There are women and adults who today are working and do not qualify for Medicaid, but they cannot afford to pay for their own health insurance. And that reality may not change. It may actually get worse because some of them may actually have to be taxed for not being able to afford to purchase health insurance, subsidies aside. And so the gaps that exist, many people will fall in between those gaps, and it will fall on the local levels, people at the state, county, municipal level, to determine how those health care costs get met. And then I feel like we're still not having an honest conversation about the people who, when you don't qualify for Medicaid, and oftentimes people are thinking about it in the context of, oh, well, such and such makes too much money to qualify for Medicaid. And the reality is there are people who make too little to qualify for Medicaid, and we need to individuals, and we need to think about that moving forward, because for states who are saying they will implement, if they implement health care, let's say they implement the exchanges but don't implement the Medicaid expansion, what does that mean? Who is being left out, and what are the implications for those states, not only monetarily, but for the public health status of the state? And so people have to be mindful and diligent in watching how states not only say they want to participate and are willing to create the exchanges, but if they say they want to implement Medicaid, they're given a lot of leeway as to how that, what that looks like. So it's incumbent upon us to be mindful. Also, I'm watching very closely a number of the states that have really vulnerable populations. Tanya and I both had the privilege of taking delegations from the South to D.C. to lobby on health care reform, and we were, and I say privileged because we were the only women of color, aside from a few groups like National Latina and immigrant women who were there, who had to bring up a number of issues, and particularly voices from the South, because prior to our presence there, a number of the majority of the voices that were being heard on Capitol Hill were the conservative voices from the South saying, we don't want federal government telling us, you know, what we need to do regarding our health care. And part of why we felt that was necessary is because the South is disproportionately impacted by healthcare laws or the lack thereof, those states in particular, how they implement healthcare reform in any form will have broad implications. So when you take into account of the 32 states that I mentioned who hadn't done any work around healthcare exchanges or healthcare reform, a lot of them are in the South, and these are areas that not only are saying they don't want to do anything regarding health care, they have some of the most arcane laws against arcane laws regarding reproductive health. A lot of them are states that have no minimum wage laws, or if they have minimum wage laws, they're below the federal level. Many of them have passed anti-immigration bills. So when you look at health care reform, what was upheld and contrasted with the Arizona bill that was upheld, which basically says, well, you know, you can't racially profile, but if the person happens to be stopped, detained for another reason, and then you happen to ask them for their papers, it's okay. So what does that mean, right? It could very well look like poor women, immigrant women going to the hospital to get care that they could not get with healthcare reform being carded and asked to show them their papers in certain states where they're more antagonistic towards the undocumented. And that's something that's important. And finally, the last point I want to make is, so a number of people, lawyers, as well as political analysts, seem to believe that because so much money is on the table regarding health care reform, that no state in their right mind would walk away. And I think what we have seen, particularly with a black president in office and people feeling like they have to resist as best they can to protect what's theirs for a number of reasons, right? Sometimes it's race, sometimes it's class, oftentimes it's political party, is that we don't necessarily know that's true. We don't know that there are states who mean it and actually will walk away from this amount of money. And many are saying, you know, the doctors and the hospitals just won't allow it. It's too much money. They actually are not going to be harmed in the short run. They just have to be prepared to bear the burden, 2017 moving forward. And states are already saying it's too much. It's too much money for us to have to worry about in the future. We're not going to do it. So what happens when a medical infrastructure is beginning to shift how it's going to receive money, because it's preparing for an influx, right? It's preparing for more people to enter the system. It's prepared for the government, Medicaid, insurance, and providers to pay them differently, so they're about to begin delivering care differently. So what does that mean for everyone who is not a part of the system? And you know, I realize I'm asking a number of questions, but they're questions that I think could be answered in collaboration as some of these things play themselves out on the state level. It's both an opportunity and a challenge, but these are some critical questions I think we need to ask as we move forward. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Heidi, for your presentation. Our last caller will be Mary. And Mary, before you begin, Kali, will you give us instructions on how to get in the queue for questions before Mary begins? Kali? Okay, Mary Goresh, Policy Committee Chair, Coordinating Committee, Vermont Workers Center. And Mary, you have about 5 minutes for your presentation, and then we'll be able to begin our conversation with our participants. Thank you, Mary.
Yes, thank you. I will try to keep it to 5 minutes, and I appreciate this call, and I'm really quite happy to hear everybody talking about how the states will have to make a go of it themselves. I'll just briefly echo the sentiment that everyone else has expressed, which is that although we're very happy that the Affordable Care Act will prevent many deaths, it really has nothing whatsoever to do with human rights or the human right to health care. And the administration, after the last UPR in our post-UPR calls, admitted this. However, they thought it was all they could do in this political climate, which is all the more reason I believe, and I think many other people believe after hearing what folks have said on this call, that we need to do this starting on a state level. And so I want to talk a little bit about the kind of paradigm shift that's necessary in order to accomplish that, and we're working on that here in Vermont, and I'm hoping that other states will be too. One of the reasons I believe that people, not the folks on this call, but the public in general, doesn't understand that the Affordable Care Act isn't about human rights is because it requires a major paradigm shift from talking about health insurance to health care. I'm certain that everyone on this call understands that, but I kind of also feel like I can't say enough that the same thing that everyone else has said. Health insurance does not mean health care. And what we've been working on in Vermont is universal health care. And what we're still trying to educate our legislators on is that when you're talking about a universal health care package, we don't need a package in there. That we've all grown up, or at least if you're as old as I have, you've grown up with thinking about healthcare as being something you get from health insurance, and whether things are covered and which things are covered and what your deductible is and what your copayment is. Universal health care removes those elements because there isn't a package. To think about a benefits package is to think about an insurance model, not a health care model. And because I firmly believe that everyone on this call is committed to human rights, and I know that grassroots human rights movements can work because it did work in Vermont. And granted, we are a small state. We also, believe it or not, are in some very conservative state. We have very many conservative people. But what we're basically talking about is having folks understand that healthcare is really a human right, because most people actually don't know that. They're likely to say, what do you mean it's a human right? So the fact that Act 48 says in the text of the law that healthcare is a public good that needs to be publicly financed is a really big thing. And the part that I think we can take away for the purposes of our healthcare as a human right movement from the Supreme Court decision is the fact that they didn't seem to have a problem with taxation being used for public goods. So therefore, the task ahead appears to be to convince other states to treat healthcare as a public good so that we might have a sort of domino effect of the states doing this. And if enough states do it and it works, then even states that are more difficult may decide to follow suit. Or who knows? Maybe even by the next UPR, we can talk to other states and get them to help our administration follow suit. Let's hope we have an administration that would be receptive. So what I would like to invite everybody to do is to join the Vermont Leads the Way campaign, and I believe AGEM sent out a link to that website for everyone. And what that is doing is supporting the grassroots movement to make certain that we all hold our state legislators accountable for acknowledging, A, that healthcare is a human right and therefore a public good, and B, that it must be publicly and equitably financed. And if you go to that link, you can individually endorse it as a supporter, and you can also find other resources on the website. There are other states who are currently working on this model. Oregon is. I know Maryland is. Pennsylvania is. Ohio is. I believe Maine is. New York is. And it seems as though the only way that we can get our government, who is so absorbed in partisan politics, to pay attention to the fact that they are a democracy and that people still vote them in, is by growing large grassroots movements that can tip the balance of power in such a way that they're able to fight back against these lobbyists who have huge, huge, huge amounts of money and who don't have any more than one vote. And I would like to think that being that we are still a democracy and that it is only people that vote and not money and not corporations, that by building a nationwide grassroots movement, we could actually accomplish the paradigm shift from health insurance health care and be supported at the UN at the next UPR, because certainly that the UN Declaration of Human Rights is very clear about that subject. And I know we're trying to stick to time limits, so I'm going to stop there, but say that I would welcome any questions or any either during this question and answer period, or if you want to email me. I don't know if AGEM sent out our emails or not, but I am retiredinvermont@hotmail.com. Thank you very much. Hello? Hi, am I still on the call?
Yeah, you're still on. Sorry about that. So I think we may have lost Tanya, unfortunately, everyone. Hopefully she can make it back in, but she may have got dropped from the call. So what I want to do in the effort to try to get her back on is just go through the Q&A process. It'll take us through 4:30. It's 4:05 now. So if everyone, if you could please keep your questions and comments to 1 minute to make sure that everyone has ample time to both answer the question and we get more people in the queue. So to join the queue, you press *1, and we'll take them in the answer if they are received. If you're directing your question to someone, one of the speakers in particular, please state their name, and we'll begin from there. So our first question is from Ken. Ken, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes, hello?
Hello, yeah, this is Ken.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, this is Tanya. I'm sorry, I apologize, I got disconnected.
Okay, we started with the Q&A, Tanya, and the first person is Ken, so
okay.
Go ahead, Ken.
Well, I have to admit it's probably not really a question, it's more of a few little comments. My name's Ken. I'm on the board of an organization called Healthcare for All Texas. So that tells you where I am. And we're affiliated with the Physicians for National Health Program and Healthcare Now, two of the major national single-payer organizations. And it's I was very heartened by the discussion that took place. You know, people that realizing that, we need to go beyond what has been put into law with the Affordable Care Act, and that it really does not meet the human rights standard, which is something that we have had as central to our campaigns as well. I also was amazed that the term single payer or Medicare for All was not spoken for the entire presentation. I know that this is emphasizing human rights, and I think that's it's a good emphasis, but we also must realize that there are going to be economic and political considerations, and there are economic and political arguments that can be made for a type of health care that will meet those criteria as well as the human rights criteria, and that is a truly universal system, such as a single-payer system.
Ken, I'm going to stop you there, unfortunately, just so we can take some other folks.
Can I just make one little comment, one quick one?
Briefly.
Okay, one brief one, and that is I'm very supportive of the Vermont movement, but I think that also people need to look at this nationally as well. I mean, there is national legislation that's been in the Congress with up to 100 co-sponsors for quite a while, H.R. 76, as well as Bernie Sanders' bill. And that especially those of us in the states that were being mentioned before that are really in some of the worst situations, like Texas, where we have the highest rate of uninsurance, the likelihood that we're going to be able to put a state model through the Texas politics is very low in the immediate future, and so there needs to be a national focus as well. And they're not mutually exclusive. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next we have Brad.
Yeah, hi, this is Brad. Brad Ott from, actually I'm vacationing in Pennsylvania, but I'm with the Committee to Reopen Charity Hospital in New Orleans. I wanted to, by the way, thanks, Ken, for the comments. I share those sentiments about single payer. I am wondering if someone could speak to the issue of the Medicaid portion of the ruling, because there is going to be this sort of new donut hole, if you will, between those people who would not qualify for Medicaid up to 100% of the federal poverty level for family size. Those between 100% and 133% would be able to actually participate in the insurance exchanges. And in fact, I predict that's going to be a very expensive proposition with the way the Medicaid ruling worked out with the Supreme Court. But I am wondering about the issue that quite literally those people who cannot qualify for Medicaid up to 100% of the federal poverty line are going to be in the same position as undocumented immigrants. They will not be able to get health care. I live in Louisiana. Our Medicaid threshold is 13%, and those adults who are not pregnant, disabled, or older than 64 do not qualify for Medicaid under any circumstance, with the exception of a special hurricane provision for the devastated areas for Katrina and Rita. And nevertheless, this is very concerning. I saw this whole thing go on, and as you may know, our governor, Bobby Jindal, has decided not to do the exchanges and stuff. So to wrap up my question, I wanted to hear a little bit more about the Medicaid provision and how activists, how human rights activists might deal with this issue.
This is Heidi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So the Medicaid provision in the ruling, basically, because a lot of people didn't even understand why they would make the ruling the way that it was, which gave the states to opt out. And the way that it's written in the ruling is it's actually a separate new federal program, the Medicaid expansion. So you have Medicaid as it was prior to 2010 or prior to the health care reform, and now you have this new federal program. And because it's a new federal program, states cannot be forced to participate, so they are given the option to opt out. And I think the question you raised is a very good one, because in theory, if you don't qualify for Medicaid, you're supposed to be subsidized so that you can be a part of the exchange. But when the exchange is not created, or the exchange is in creation, or when they finally do create the exchange, you know, there are certain state stipulations, like what does that look like? And I think that's where the being active at the state level is going to be critical, particularly because there's so many states that have not set up anything. We have few who've done study committees, and then you have a very small number who have opted to already expand Medicaid to include individual adults. They've done that in the last year, and then you have another, I think, 14 who have agreed. I'm sorry, 14 who have actually established a state exchange, so they're like ready to go. They're ready to go at the beginning of next year and be in compliance with all the deadlines. So what happens? And I think that's one of the questions that we're asking, and this is one of those moments where it's incumbent upon not just people who are going to receive these benefits, who are going to be going for medical care, but it's an opportunity for strategic partnerships with hospitals, with providers, to say, let's make a real system that can bolster and support the health care of as many people as possible.
Kali, can I respond to the first question? This is Anya from Nesri.
Go ahead, Anya.
Thank you. This was I didn't know whether we were collecting questions or not, but, in response to Kim's question, I totally appreciate the point about, you know, states like Texas and also, as we just heard, Louisiana, that it's, you know, it may seem a bit of a idealistic goal to have a universal tax-funded healthcare system as in Vermont. But I would like to ask them to consider two things. One is that we need a few states, more than one, but probably not all 50, to adopt universal healthcare and then cause a sort of a domino effect. So that then, you know, once a few states have done it, the rest of the country will follow at the national level. So clearly we don't want to stop at the state level. We want to follow the Canada's model where Saskatchewan started and then eventually some other provinces adopted it and then it became national. So the focus is national. I do want to confirm that. But I also would like to encourage people in states such as the southern states to not abandon their states in the sense of, you know, just looking to Washington, D.C. There's very little and probably nothing that can get done in D.C. now or in the foreseeable future. And I think what the question from Louisiana and Heidi's response just highlighted that it is so crucial to build a movement on the ground, a grassroots movement for improving the implementation of the right to health care in your state. And that may not be, you may not go as far as Vermont, but you can certainly go towards having more people included in the Medicaid program and so on and so forth. So, but you need to, you know, do what a lot of you are already doing, which is really the grassroots movement building work. It's only that can get it done. And I'm not sure how far you'll get using arguments for a single-payer system. I mean, it seems, you know, in our experience, it's the single-payer frame is a little technical, and it's not that easy for people to understand. It's a bit more of a healthcare policy long term, which is why we felt like by looking at, you know, the values we want to see in a human rights based healthcare system, that is universality and equity, for example, that resonates much more as you're building a movement for the right to healthcare than simply pointing to single payer as a solution. And that doesn't mean we don't, you know, as human rights advocates don't agree with that solution. NESRI has done a human rights assessment of single payer, national single payer proposals, and they meet pretty human rights standards reasonably well. So that's not the concern. The concern is that really where people are going to follow in terms of pushing for the right to health care in their own states, in terms of the steps that are needed to move states, even a state like Louisiana or Texas. So that's sort of, you know, my response to the question so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anya. Next we have Laura Turiano. Laura?
Hi, everyone. I'm Laura. I work with People's Health Movement, which is a global network of activists for the right to health. I agree with much of what has been said, and I really appreciate all the detailed information that has been given on the call. However, my concern about something that's kind of been left out is that if we're taking a human rights approach, we really need to look at the root causes of human rights violations, and we have to go beyond the sort of pluses and minuses analysis to consider why we have the system we have, why we have gotten this particular law now after years of healthcare reform activism. And I think we have to put the law into the context of the corporate takeover of our democracy that's been carried out over the last 30, 40 years, that's led to a situation where, you know, public opinion, public interest, and evidence has little relevance in policymaking right now, and recognize that the real action in the debate over this law was a competition between different segments of the healthcare industry to secure the biggest subsidy and the most beneficial regulations for their own benefit. And the result is that the ACA really addresses all the major threats to the profitability of pharmaceutical insurance and other segments of the industry. And in terms of the major elements of the bill, regular people really only benefit mostly as a side effect of bailing out those industries. And, you know, anyone who predicted that this law was going to be overturned doesn't really understand the political economy of the law. Too many large corporate interests support the law for this government to overturn it. And you know, we do have to recognize that the way our system is structured right now healthcare, drugs, insurance, et cetera, are all products like any other, and we have to start thinking like the businesses that make these products and services to understand what is really going on in the system and how, where are the power relationships and how we can change it. Because this law essentially reinforces a market-based capitalist healthcare system. And in my opinion, any time spent working on supporting the implementation of its major provisions that is taking time away from not fighting for this grassroots movement for a real health system that will make all Americans healthier and fulfill the right to health is really a huge political mistake. I think a lot of NGOs in this country who have like put a lot of effort behind supporting the implementation of this bill are really detracting from the real human rights movement for the right to health. Thank you for putting together a call.
Thank you very much. I want to remind everyone, if you have a question, please to press star 1 to get in the queue. We really appreciate all the questions and statements thus far. We want to encourage folks to keep it to a very short comment or question to make sure that everybody is able to participate. Once again, it's star 1. The next speaker, Ajamu Baraka.
Thank you. I really wanted to just say very briefly, I appreciate the network pulling this call together. It's very timely and, of course, important. I'm also glad to hear a few things, but make my very quick question. I'm glad to hear that there is a growing perception that we have to begin to shift paradigms. We have to begin to take a look at struggle on the state level. I think that's very, very important. I'm glad to hear also, too, that the sister Tanya and Heidi were able to take people from the South to be involved in the lobbying effort in Washington, so people can understand the particularities that we face here in the Southern region. And I'm also glad to hear my old friend Mary and outstanding work that they're involved in up there in Vermont. A quick question is this for Anja and for Heidi. What particular states might we prioritize in this new effort to try to build a bottom-up movement on the state level? And what kinds of structures do you see us developing on the state level to in fact, coordinate this kind of effort?
Yeah, thanks, Ajamu. That's a really good question. I mean, I think we can all do our part, and we don't always have to work in the same states. I mean, I can tell you what we feel is important to prioritize is those states where we actually see a grassroots human rights movement developing, where people actually come together and have this broader perspective in mind. That is a shift in the way the healthcare system works, the paradigm shift that Mary was working, was referring to, but also embedding that in the broader understanding and promotion of human rights and social justice as a whole. So that it's not just about changing a specific health insurance model, but that it's about getting to healthcare for all and then getting to human rights and social justice for all. So those kinds of movements are the movements that we're supporting, and we see those taking place in a very emerging nascent form in Oregon and in Maryland and potentially also in the Worker Center. The Vermont Worker Center can say more about that in Maine. So those are the states where we have seen the energy to really build something that's going to be very long term, but that is devoted to realizing the human rights of all of us. And I feel like those are really important efforts to support. But that doesn't exclude any other efforts elsewhere.
This is Heidi. So my suggestion has been and will continue to be until I see the traction necessary is to start with the South. There is a misguided notion outside of the South, I think, that if we pretend like the South doesn't exist or if we put together enough of our progressive wishes, the South will somehow accept some of those well wishes and become more progressive. And the reality is the South tends to resist more. And it's not just with health care. It's everything, education, welfare reform, criminal justice. The South tends to be the place that we cross-pollinate out. we manage to make sure that the conservative values that most impact the vulnerable in the South go to other states and make them more conservative, and they create a new brand of conservatism in different areas. And so I think we need to start in the South, the Deep South, because that's where the need is. And when we prioritize the most vulnerable, the communities that are most disenfranchised, immigrant women, women of color, I think then we can begin to, and we have to prioritize them in a way where we're building a cross-cultural movement, a broad-based movement where all of the segments come together, labor, women, LGBT. We have to be very strategic. The healthcare debate, I think, lends itself to very unique partnerships, people who we've never thought of partnering with before, simply because the assumption is now that there's a guaranteed pool of money for everyone to take part in. So hospitals are going to get money, providers are going to get money, insurance companies are going to get money. The assumption is it will change how healthcare is delivered. That may be true, but we still have to make sure that it's delivered in a way that is actually prioritizing good health. And that's the key, right? Like, we want healthcare reform to protect our health, make us healthier, not sustain the status quo. So I think we need to think outside of the box. Who have we not been partnering with that could really help us shift the tide and make the exchanges and healthcare at the local level look the way we need it to look so that our communities are happy and healthy and safe?
Thank you very much, Heidi. I know one of the things that I wanted to lend to the conversation about organizing in the South, which is oftentimes marginalized in broader national conversations for many of the reasons that you mentioned, is that it provides us with a unique opportunity to build local leadership in a way in which is possible to shift paradigms. And I think it's important for us, when we talk about what a win looks like in the South, oftentimes is fundamentally different than it looks like in more progressive states, particularly as we organize around politically contentious issues. Oftentimes we understand that legislation will start in one of the more conservative states because they think just in the same way that Saskatchewan was for Canada and universal health care, the southern states will be for the rest of the nation. If you adopt that model in one of the more conservative states, whether it be in the South or in Arizona, then in fact it will catch on like wildfire. For those of us who are involved in reproductive health, particularly when the controversy about contraception began in Congress, while it didn't pass, the effort spread like wildfire throughout the states, and oftentimes it started in the most conservative states. And in fact, what we've seen is efforts to roll back things like access to contraception care, contraception in states like Georgia. Even if it hadn't passed, conversations which we thought were dead and buried have emerged again because of health care reform. But I think one of the most important things that we found organizing in southern state legislatures, particularly around politically contentious things like contraception, is it has offered us opportunity to build cross-movement build with immigrants community, just as Heidi mentioned. We're having a conversation with organized labor in ways in which we hadn't had in the past, with the women's rights group, racial justice organizations. It has been an interesting conversation to have and find points of unique intersections and understanding how raising visibility, particularly of grassroots organizations that have traditionally not worked together, has lended itself, particularly in state legislatures, to not only greater presence, but we may not get the most draconian legislation. So even if the bill doesn't pass, or maybe if it passes, it doesn't pass in the most draconian form. And that is what a win looks like in a state where you have all the constitutional officers which are conservative and many of whom come to each legislative session with an agenda and a list of bills which they are committed to passing and nearly have the opportunity to put any bill they want up for constitutional amendment. That's part of the reality that we're operating in the South, and I think it's important to shift the national dialogue and paradigm on what that win looks like, because it's not necessarily going to be universal health care, but it is going to be raising the visibility of how communities are affected by the unwillingness of our elected officials to represent interests of states where you have a quarter of the population, as in somewhere like Texas, or 20% in Louisiana or in Georgia, that have people who are uninsured and some of the poorest healthcare outcomes. Oftentimes, forcing those conversations into the open is what is empowering to our communities, because it forces elected officials to be held accountable and on the record in ways in which they probably wouldn't have in the past. So I don't think we have AGEM is going to close. We do not have any more questions. I want to thank all of you who participated in the call, our presenters, and those of you who have raised critical considerations of things that were omitted as a part of this dialogue. As I mentioned from the beginning, this is the beginning of a conversation and not the end. And I want to thank you from the perspective of the network, and AGEM is going to close it out. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Tanya, for that very strong appeal at the end. And thank you to the speakers for really closing out this discussion on what we need to be doing moving forward. And I think that we have many participants on the call who have already heard the appeal to look at this at a state-based solution, and hope you've heard the call that we really look at starting in the South. Thank you, everyone, for the insightful questions, for our fantastic speakers, Tanya, for the great facilitation. We really appreciate everybody joining. It's clear that we have a lot more work to do in order to realize the right to health care in this country, and really to shift the way we think about what the right to health care would look like, shift the discourse. I want to end by urging everyone to please consider joining the network. You can join as an individual or as an organization, and to join, just go to the Join Us button at www.ushrnetwork.org. Again, that's ushrnetwork.org. And one last thing, if you are interested in receiving any of the resources that were mentioned, and if they were not, if those resources were not sent in the initial email, please feel free to reach out to us. You can send an email to me at edike@ushrnetwork.org, or to our info@ushrnetwork.org. Again, thank you, everyone, for joining. And if you're interested in an additional opportunity to discuss the human rights implications of these decisions, look at our email. We made an announcement about an additional opportunity organized by the Center for Human Rights at American University on July 18th. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye.